This is ContactTalkRadio.com, consciousness in action, and you are taking action into your consciousness by tuning into Contact Talk Radio.
And on TuneIn.com, Ping.fm, and UpSnap Mobile.
Contact Talk Radio.
Welcome to Evolutionary Collective Conversations with Patricia Albert. The next evolutionary leap for humanity is a critical shift from individual to global consciousness. This higher level of development takes us beyond our individual self-concern into expanding capacities for unity, interconnectedness, evolutionary relating, and collective intelligence. Contemporary spiritual teacher and visionary Patricia Albert engages deep and probing dialogues with frontline luminaries shaping the next wave of conscious evolution. Please welcome Patricia Albert.
Hi, everyone. Welcome. Today, we're going to speak about lying as violence, which is a pretty strong title, but I'm going to be here speaking about it with Dr. Keith Witt, who is a therapist and author of a number of books, but he's an author of an upcoming book, Integral Mindfulness, Clueless to Dialed In, which will be coming out, I believe, at least within the next 6 months. And we're going to talk about the impact of living in a world where deception, denial, and lying are unfortunately part of the fabric of life. And, you know, socially, we exist inside of a kind of numbness, you know, that keeps us asleep to the harm or damage of this kind of lying. And violence is a very strong word, but it's defined as a destructive force used to harm or damage someone or something. So, you know, Keith and I are going to explore the impact of lying coming from, you know, a bunch of different perspectives, as usual, and also that we both have a shared experience. I mean, Keith has worked with, he's an incredible therapist. I mean, just, you know, from my experience, about as brilliant as you could be. He's brilliant, but he's also incredibly committed to people and incredibly skillful at helping people with the various issues that they have and with their lives. So, you know, when you spent 50,000 hours, you know, being with people with their lives, you get to see a pretty wide scan of lying, you know, and how deception and lying and the impact that it has, you know, in real human life. And I've spent 40 years, you know, working with people in groups and also doing one-on-one and, you know, have probably an equal, but maybe slightly different, but very equal reality on the impact of lying. So, and what it is and kind of how it works. So I think we'll have a very exciting time together. Keith also has also done a number of TED Talks that, you can just Google his name, Dr. Keith Witt, and he's got three different TED Talks that you can watch. And he has also a wonderful website called The School of Love. And so, welcome, Keith. I'm glad you're here today.
I'm glad to be here.
Good. So why don't we just start with the simple, you know, the first thing is, you know, what is lying and how would you define violence? And then we can sort of get into the topic.
Sure. Violence is the cause of all the problems in the world. At its base, if the human capacity for violence, which is to objectify somebody or something or someone or somehow, and to cause injury unnecessarily, to cause injury through malice, that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. That's the cause of all the problems. And lying lying is a form of discourse. It's kind of like language or touch. But, you know, touch, there's a continuum. There's a certain point with touch where it becomes violence, where there's injury being caused to another person, usually with some kind of knowledge of injury being caused. And the same is true for lying. A fourth of lies are told purely to protect other people. And those lies generally are just part of social discourse. Because when we're around each other, we're always gauging what can we handle. And if I'm telling somebody some truth that is going to cause them to be injured unnecessarily, that doesn't serve love, in my opinion. And so we're always making that adjustment. But there is a point where we will deceive or lie or something, and most people do it a couple of times a week. Well, we're doing it purely for ourselves and sometimes to injure another person, and then that's violence. And on varying levels, that causes an awful lot of social malaise and an awful lot of problems in relationships. Some lies are so profound in a relationship that a relationship will never recover from them. They're signature attachment injuries. And of course, I've observed this throughout my professional career. And in general, when you grow, you become more honest. And it's interesting, you know, the term brutally honest. I think brutally honest is people are lying to themselves. Because in general, if you're honest in a way where you're empathically attuned with another person, you can always be kind. And so I trust kind honesty. Don't really trust brutal honesty. Usually beneath the surface in brutal honesty, there's an agenda. There's a power agenda or a narcissistic agenda or something. And so that's how it works. And then how do we deal with it? Well, it's really difficult because an awful lot of lies have to deal with us lying to ourselves first.
Mm-hmm.
And so to a certain extent, lying involves what's our intent. You know, like what I knew about the world 30 years ago, and I was saying what I believed was true, and that sensation of what was true is just as clear as it is today. But there's a lot of the facts that I've discovered are different facts. And I look back, and I was deluding myself and then deluding other people. And so it's a lot more complicated than it sounds at first. But one thing that you can really tell is that if you're telling a lie, somehow to serve that diminishes another person or somehow serves yourself and blocks the other person off empathically, that's a subtle form of violence. And the person will feel that, and it will injure them and it will injure the relationship. And indeed, most liars will, when they're describing a conversation when they lie, they'll say that the conversations are less pleasant and less intimate. They know that when they're lying that it affects the quality of the mutuality.
That's great. It is a huge topic, actually.
It really is.
It really is. There's normal sort of societal health.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sort of what's expected and what would be, you know, better in most circles, right?
Yeah.
You know, normal life. And then, you know, moving things up towards more higher consciousness, like you were saying, you know, the more awake people seem to be, the higher their consciousness. One would hope, you know, that the level of authenticity and honesty would also increase.
Yeah, it tends to, in my experience. That as intimacy becomes deeper and more mature, and people become deeper themselves, there's more of a sense of reckless honesty, but it's based in kindness.
Yeah.
A good example, you know, my wife Becky and I, we're very honest with each other about when we're bored with when the other person's talking.
Right.
Okay, so if you can break that barrier and actually say, you know, that's boring, You can take it a step farther. You can go, you know, I was interested the first 90 seconds, and I got bored the last 30 seconds. Okay. Well, for Becky, that ceases to be, if I say that to her, if she says that to me, we tend to not feel as injured by being bored the last 30 seconds and kind of be interested, wow, when did it shift from being interesting to being boring? And then that's an interesting conversation.
Right.
But that requires an awful lot of trust in each other, because in other relationships, you tell somebody they're getting bored when they're talking. People are so sensitive neurologically and spiritually that actually could injure a relationship. For instance, women tend to tell more lies just to protect another person than men do, and little girls tend to play more in dyads than boys do, when they're growing up, and boys tend to play more in groups. And in those dyads, little girls will tend to put more energy into maintaining the relationship. Boys tend to put more energy into dominance. And so that's why 10 to 20, there's 10 or 20 times more lies told that are false positives. Wow, that looks great and so on, or I think that was an interesting thing you said, than false negatives. Why we have a certain part of us that is biased towards maintaining the relationship. That's one form of lying that can gradually change as you get closer and closer. And interestingly, people who have a really good same-sex friendship are less likely to lie, because friendship really, you can have a horrible marriage and stay married. Generally, if you have a horrible friendship, you'll start to stop seeing your friends. And so those relationships are kind of based on a sense of mutual trust. That if you're going to lie to me, you're not going to lie to me to betray me. You're going to probably lie to me to protect me in some fashion. And that's a more forgivable lie. That's not experienced as violence.
Well, just to move it, but just in speaking about sort of like that, you know, that higher level of connecting authentically or honestly, it does also seem that there are people where, you know, the more in fear you are, the more you're going to tend to lie.
Yes.
Or the more attached you are to sort of greedily getting what you want, you know, sort of, which is a sort of lower level of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Or the more in pride, you know, if you're very filled with, you know, needing to maintain a certain self-image and, you know, you're going to be lying to yourself, you're going to be, you know, sort of puffing yourself up and making sure that you look a certain way. So the experience that I have is when people start to move into a place where they have more courage and they have less fear, they're less willing to trade off by lying. Because it actually doesn't feel good. I mean, I was kind of lucky because in my family of origin with my parents, they were like insanely honest people, you know, kind of in a simple way. It wasn't complicated. It was just that they just were very straight up, you know, and just never lied as far as I know. You know, I mean, there wasn't any of that going on. And they required that of us, you know, I mean, in a way that there was no pressure. It was just that it was safe to be honest. And so I always find it very hard to be in social situations where everybody's, you know, it's hard. I don't know how to negotiate, you know, when everybody's like pretending and, you know, and I can feel it, you know, the more conscious you get too, the more you can actually feel the subtle lies.
Mm-hmm.
Even the nice social ones, you can actually feel the reality of what someone is actually experiencing towards you.
Yeah.
And then something else coming out of their mouth. And it really is, it's difficult. I mean, it actually becomes, you know, it's something you can still manage, but you feel how complicated it is to live in a way where you have to sort of worry about everybody's self-image and, you know, whether somebody gets offended or, I mean, it's just like the, on an ego level, it's kind of like a, to me, it feels like landmines.
Mm-hmm. I, first of all, you know, when you told me that about your, just now about your family, I thought, wow, well, that really explains, you know, your developmental arc, because, you know, you've been searching for deeper truth all your life.
Right, that's,
you know,
true.
You just kind of were launched at 19 and never looked back. You know, my kids had a similar experience. They're 28 and 25 now. When they were teenagers, they had problems socially because their friends would say, "Well, don't tell your parents about this," or, you know, "Tell your parents we're going to do this." And my kids, both of them, would say, "I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to lie to my parents." It's like for them, that was unpleasant. And we do have. All of us are plugged in. You know, there's when we're in relationship, the intersubjective fields that are anchored in mirror neuron systems in our brains and so on, we know when some bullshit is happening, and lies are kind of the ultimate bullshit. And, you know, we can tell it in a large sense. We can tell it in a small sense. If we're dedicated to growth in relationship and personally, growth generally is characterized by more and more rigorous honesty and self-reflection. And you'll find, you can tell the difference between real growth and bogus growth, in my opinion, because bogus growth, you lose the kindness. You lose the compassion.
Right.
And real growth, there's more love there. And that the more honesty, even if it's about difficult topics, there's more love there. I see this with couples a lot. You know, couples will come in talking about really difficult, you know, sometimes betrayals, infidelity, and, you know, all the kinds of things that people do to each other. And of course, couples are most like people, you're most likely to tell the biggest lies to the people you're closest to.
Right.
So just statistically, that's the case, unfortunately. But then when people start talking in an accepting way about, you know, whatever it is, all of a sudden everything calms down. There's a kind of a little bit of compassion enters into the room. And there's a lot of neurobiology about this that I find fascinating. I think you're dead on when you talk about fear. When our nervous system perceives threat, it goes into a defensive state where we begin to want to protect ourselves, fight or flight, and we get distorted. And one thing that happens in the brain is your capacity for empathy and self-reflection get interfered with in that defensive state. And so if you're wanting to protect yourself, if you're wanting to fight or flee, and this is where violence come in, sometimes the way that you fight or sometimes the way that you flee is you tell a lie. And you're not particularly self-reflective, and you're not particularly empathically engaged at that moment. And to do violence to another person, you have to disengage empathically. Because unless you're a total Hannibal Lecter-type psychopath, and there's hardly any of those, you can't look somebody in the eye and hurt them and stay empathically engaged. You have to disengage that. And that's what defensive states do. And one thing about lies is that they tend to come out of those defensive states. You know, when we're scared, and generally when we're angry, it's because we're scared. I mean, basically, anger and fear and hurt all co-vary. They all happen about the same time.
Yeah.
They separate us. And, you know, lies separate us.
Yeah, totally. I mean, the other thing I think that people often don't recognize, and it's really loud to me, you know, I always like feel it sort of physically, is that when you're lied to, you know, especially when it's significant, you're being cheated. So you're actually being stolen from. So if you're in a relationship and the person is not really telling the truth about the fact that they don't want to be in the relationship anymore, or, you know, on a, you know, more drastic level, they've cheated on you, or, you know, but even just like they're really thinking they don't want to be together with you anymore. And they don't want to say anything because they're basically protecting themselves. Usually it's not you. You know, they're trying to like figure out where they really are before they make any move. You're the whole time, you don't have the opportunity to actually know what's going on clearly.
Yeah.
So that you have a choice about how you want to deal with the situation of that they don't know how they feel. You know, you're being like taken from.
Yeah.
And
injured.
I think
you're being injured. That's a form of violence.
And they're taking something from you. It's like literally like, excuse me, I'm over here. What about my choice about what's occurring between us?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's okay for you to be going through whatever you're going through, but we're in this together. Like, that isn't your choice to make.
Yeah.
You know, just like when if a woman lies to a man, if she gets pregnant and decides not to let him know, you know, that she's getting an abortion or something, like, there's something just inherently, I mean, she can still get the abortion, but it's like to not at least be open and honest about something that's actually affecting both of you feels, you know, completely violent to me.
I agree. I think that this illustrates one huge factor in intimate relationships, which is you guys in the EC talk about it in terms of commitment. I might use the word resolve more often, though there means kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
You really need to know what you're about in a relationship. You know, if I'm resolved to have a loving relationship with somebody, say a lover, let's talk about it with a lover. So intimate relationships go through different stages, and you go through periods, all relationships that last longer than a few minutes go through, you know, different stages. And if you go through a stage where you're pissed off at somebody, you're disgusted with somebody, or whatever, if you know my job is to work through this with them to get back to love, if you have that resolve, if you have that commitment, then that guides you into what to do. If you're not resolved, if you're foggy about your commitment, if you're foggy about your resolve, you're kind of left to drift around your defensive impulses. And that's where you get the kind of lies that you're talking about. And this is one thing I tell couples. You know, somebody goes in and it comes in and they says, you know, I don't know if I want to be with this guy or not. And I go, okay, well, let's you and I talk about it until you're clear about where you are right now, and then let's bring him into it. Because one thing that you really don't want to talk to your partner about is, you know, I don't know if I want to be with you or not. You know, on one hand, you're a good guy, but on the other hand, you lied to me about this. On one hand, you know, never have that conversation with another person. Approach them with, okay, you know, I'm ambivalent, but I want us to be good, and so let's go through this thing that I'm ambivalent about. Okay, so you can feel the difference. There's more integrity in the second part, which involves basically, this is where lying to ourselves is a form of violence to ourselves, kind of a form of psychological self-mutilation, really. If I'm lying to myself about who I am or what I want, that's going to cause me to do it to other people. And, you know, you just see so much damage from this. And you see it through worldviews, because we grow through worldviews. In terms of integral perspective, people have different morality about it. If you're a fundamentalist, then you believe that faith trumps science. Okay, and if somebody says that science trumps faith, that feels immoral to you. And so if you're a scientist, if you're a rational person, you think science trumps faith, and you feel it's immoral if somebody doesn't do that. And so that sense of righteous indignation drives a certain level of normalizing. Well, then it's okay to, you know, I have this righteous indignation. I don't have to care as much about this other person. I don't have to focus on the fact that there's these subtle nuances. I can just kind of push. You know, you say it with pluralistic people, you know, the pluralistic people who want everybody to be taken care of all the time, science, if they see science and faith being privileged over caring for every individual, they feel like that's immoral. And so if you don't have an awareness of that in yourself, you'll have a tendency to make judgments and objectify people that you disagree with. And when we start objectifying other people, when someone else is an object, all of a sudden it's more okay to do violence to them. It's more okay to lie to them. It's more okay to deceive them. It's more okay to do all kinds of things. And like I said, the violence is what causes all the problems in this world, mostly by people objectifying each other.
It's a great point. What we're going to do is we're going to take a short break. And when I come back, I'm here with Dr. Keith Witt, and we're speaking about lying as violence. And I also want to give people an opportunity, if you're out there and you'd like to ask a question, just dial 877-230-3062, 877-230-3062. You could call right now if you want, and they'll hold you on the line, and you're more than welcome to ask any questions that you might have. Okay, we'll be back in a moment.
Mutual awakening is the experience of awakening together. There is a powerful and simple practice that allows people to move into an awakened relational field. Spiritual luminaries Patricia Albert and Jeff Carrera are happy to announce their new book, Mutual Awakening, Opening into a New Paradigm of Human Relatedness. In this book, they share exciting wisdom about a new dimension of consciousness and how it can be accessed. The book is available as a free download at www.ecdownload.com. Go to ecdownload.com and download your copy today. Something huge is happening. Over the past decade, spiritual teachers and visionaries have noticed that a new kind of consciousness is beginning to open. It's a level of consciousness, a 21st century awakening, that only emerges through a new kind of relatedness. The Evolutionary Collective has been at the forefront of this emergence since the beginning. Patricia Albert invites you to go to www.evolutionarycollective.com to receive a free audio download and find out more. That's www.evolutionarycollective.com.
Hi, everyone. It's Patricia Albert, and I'm here with Dr. Keith Witt, and we are speaking about, we've been inquiring into lying as violence. So in continuing in that line, Keith, one of the things that we started to talk about was, you know, this sort of higher level of less fear, more honesty, obviously less objectification as well.
Yeah.
You know, you were making a really strong point that, which is great, you know, like when we see the other as an object and we can slip into that, like in a, you know, in a nanosecond, then at that moment, it's easy to then treat the other violently, insensitively. You know, we don't really feel them anymore. You know, they're not real. I mean, people do that with animals. They do that with the planet. You know, we do that with everything. So I wanted to talk a little bit about, as we have more consciousness, as there is less fear and there is more of a desire, like we were saying about your kids and, you know, my experience of you know, my life anyway, is it seems that it's easier. Like once you cross over into a certain level of honesty and clarity and, you know, connection, you know, I never experienced that the truth was something mean. Do you know what I mean? It felt, mm-hmm. It always felt like a relief. You know, I always preferred to have somebody tell me what was really happening or tell me that I made them uncomfortable or if I was, you know, doing something that was difficult, like that they cared enough actually to be honest and cared enough about our relationship to be honest so that something could actually shift and that it wasn't, you know, because the moment people don't do that, usually there's distancing in my experience. You know, the moment you don't do it, what part of the violence is, you know, I don't tell you that moment where you're being boring or whatever it is, or then I'm immediately have decided, okay, well, Keith, you know, he does this, so I'll tune out. You know, I mean, I make a whole decision about who you are mm-hmm. and I decide about how I'm going to deal with you in the future. And our relationship is that much smaller. Mm-hmm. I mean, that happens so often. I mean, you end up with often polite relationships that have no real contact after a while.
Yeah, which are boring.
Right, right. So talk a little bit about, like, you know, your experience or, you know, what you see when you're working with people where they really start to abide in, you know, they kind of get over their terror of being honest, and they discover that it's actually a different world mm-hmm. to live in, that the consciousness of being genuinely honest is different. Like, what do you see when you're working with people, and how is that for you?
The first, this is surprisingly difficult developmentally. Now it may, and I'll say what I mean by that. We're always judging ourselves and other people. Nervous systems judge. You know, brains are always sending out, looking and doing social referencing. And most of evolution over the last couple of million years has been in response to social pressures. In other words, the biggest threat to humans the last couple of million years haven't really been all the animals that everybody always talks about in evolution, a saber-toothed tiger and a mammoth and whatnot. No, it's been other human beings. You know, so we've evolved to be safe with other human beings because they've been the biggest threat and they've been the biggest sources of support. And so in normal development of consciousness, people develop shame dynamics. I wrote a book called The Gift of Shame about this because I felt it was so misunderstood. And in the process, we've learned to be critical of ourselves when we're behaving in a way that's not moral according to our standard. And little kids hide that. You know, when that sense of shame that you feel when you're doing something wrong feels bad. And little kid nervous systems are not mature enough to have compassionate understanding of multiple perspectives, and so they learn to hide that shame. A 16-month-old child can hide its emotions from a parent, and does. A 3-year-old learns how to lie, and 6-year-olds, by the time they're 6, are lying routinely a couple times a day. This is normal development. And so we need to be able to self-observe in a way where we're not getting lost in shame when we make a mistake or we violate our own moral code or we do something bad, because if we get lost in shame, we'll go into denial and repression, all that other stuff. We need to be able to observe it and say, okay, now I need to make an adjustment towards being more virtuous. I need to follow my moral standard. I need to refine it, something like that. That level of self-observation is necessary to have the kind of relationship that you're describing, an evolutionary relationship. And that's a developmental milestone, to have that kind of self-observation. We don't even have the neural architecture to begin to have that until we're 14 or 15 years old. And then we have a lot of habitual lies that we tell ourselves about ourselves and the world in place that need to be deconstructed through development. And often that happens in relationship because we can see, like you said, we tell a lie to someone and they shrink a little bit. So if I feel bad about that, I can either go into making them wrong for shrinking, or I can go, I just injured them by telling them a lie. I want to repair that somehow. And that level of self-observation then can lead me to say, oh, I just lied about that. That's not really true. It's based in a kind of rigorous self-honesty and self-observation. This is why meditation helps us grow so fast. Meditation literally strengthens the circuits in our frontal cortex that are associated with self-observation and compassion. And when those are robust enough and we can apply those to ourselves, then we're kind of more able to do that with other people. And then, you know, the whole concept of lying, since it's based in this sense of mutuality, just becomes more interesting. I'll give you an example. You know, Becky was late. She overslept an appointment with one of her friends. So she called a friend up and said, she actually forgot. And she called her up and she says, oh, I overslept. And she put up, and she hung up the phone. I said, you lied to her. She said, oh, I couldn't tell her that I forgot about the appointment. I said, well, Donna, I don't want you to lie to me. And she looked at me and laughed. She said, I lie to you all the time. And I went, what? And what she meant was, you know, there's some things you just let go and some things you talk about. And she's basing it on a deeper sense of truth, of integrity in our mutuality. And so, I don't know. I mean, I can't think of an example, but you get my point. You know, we're dealing with a level of commitment to connection and self-observation with interest and compassion. And when two people do that together, there's an intersubjective field. You know, you and I have it right now. It's just yummy. And, you know, if you've experienced it, you know what it's like. And if you haven't experienced it, it's kind of indescribable. And, you know, the exercise you do in the EC, what are you experiencing right now, is really a radical truth exercise.
Yeah.
The people are taught, you know, I feel tight, I feel loose, I feel interested, I feel scared, I feel... And the exercise does not allow people to deflect away from the immediacy of the truth of the moment.
Right.
Now, that practice, as you do it, starts feeling really interesting, really yummy, you know, really intimate.
Right.
And then that quality, that flavor of intimacy can lend itself to more complicated conversations where now we are talking about the past and we are talking about the future and we are talking about ideas or about maybe some more complicated feelings about I might have about you or thoughts or even judgments that we can examine with each other. Go on.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, it requires that level of self-observation and that willingness to be wrong. the willingness to receive influence. If I don't have a willingness to change my perspective if I'm given better data or to be wrong, then what I end up doing with you when we're talking is if there's tension, I end up advocating rather than communicating. And there's a loss of connection there. And then out of that comes a certain amount of self-deception, and then self-deception leads to deceiving you. And we can both feel it because there's an absence, you know, we feel the diminishment of the pleasure of our mutuality and kind of an increase of irritation or tension or whatever.
Right. Well, it's interesting, in doing, like you were saying, and talking about the practice that we work with, and which is so simple, but you're right. It's like it's the ability to turn towards truth, like in that moment, and truth as an intimacy. To me, it's the same. Do you know what I mean? To be intimate with oneself, you know, to really be like acutely aware of exactly, you know, how you feel and, you know, the way things are occurring for you. You can't be in some kind of egoic self-deception or, you know, trying to prop up some way of knowing oneself, you know, trying to reify, you know, a certain kind of identity that you're rooted in. Mm-hmm. You have to let go. I mean, you actually have to let go and just discover the exactness of what's there.
Yeah.
Including, I feel nervous. I feel a little bit numb. I feel like I want to lie to you. You know, I feel like I want to run away from this moment. You know, I mean, whatever the hell is there is fine. But it does start to take apart the ego, I think, that, you know, the identity itself, because that's sort of the root of all the separation anyway.
And all egoic fixations are not created equal.
Right.
There's some personality structures, generally as a result of combination of genetic heritage and neglect or abuse, where if you press somebody around where they're deceiving themselves or they're deceiving you, they go crazy. And those people, go on.
But I'm just going to say there's no pressure. It's like when you turn towards it with openness, towards whatever the truth is, the truth could be, there's no pressure. It's like I feel a little bit bound and I feel not willing to go farther at this moment. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's equally truthful.
Yeah, if you could, and you notice there's an inherent self-acceptance and acceptance of the other under those circumstances.
Right.
I can be talking to you and you feel injured. And then I go, and you go, God, that hurt, you know, mm-hmm. something. And like when I said, you know, you guys in the EC, well, you know, I was in the EC 4 years. I should have said us guys in the EC, you know.
Right.
Okay. And so, if you were injured and I said, well, I'm sorry you felt injured about that and so on. If you're being rigorously self, you know, if you're connected, you'll feel my genuine basic intent was to, you know, to cause no harm, and you'll feel my genuine correction, you know, if I corrected myself. And then you shift your perspective. You know, the truth shifts towards what's more true. This is when scientists wax lyrical about science, because science, you know, the right quadrants and integral in its purest form has the basic allegiance to the truth, and if something isn't true, it just kind of steps away. On an emotional level, that's kind of more complicated because we have a basic allegiance to love and to the deeper sense of honesty and respect that we have for each other. That needs to, and we're all very, very sensitive about that. And so on the higher levels, you're able to see your own capacities to kind of get weird. And you go, oh, I'm getting weird here. Well, if I'm saying I'm getting weird here, you don't have to manage my weirdness. You can just sit there and help me be honest with myself about my weirdness.
Okay, right.
That's a relaxing conversation.
Right.
When I start lying to myself and lying to you, no, it's not me being weird, you're being weird, okay? You can just feel how it shifts. And that is just rampant in, that's maybe 80 or 90% of human conversation. And then we get to the top few percent where it's not that. It's based in a kind of a radical self-honesty, a self-observation, a radical connection with each other, you know, with the goal of kindness, respect, and, you know, and love. And it just
and also growth.
Yeah.
I mean, the other part is if you have, if you're lucky to have a relationship where you've both made it clear, like you were saying, you know, being clear about even being in the relationship, but that you want to grow together and you want to be more awake, you know, not just, you know, not hurt each other.
Yeah.
But, you know, then if, you know, what shows up is, you know, I say something that has some judgment in it or whatever, and you say, whoa, that hurt. Then I get a chance to, instead of just feeling ashamed, you know, I can feel into like, wow, you know, what was that judgment about? You know, it's like I feel, oh, I get it. You know, I felt hurt about da-da-da-da, you know? I mean, I remember there were times with my son, you know, where he would say something. He was trying to be helpful. You know, he would say, give me some advice or something. He's like young. And it was nasty. It was just mean. And I'd say, that wasn't helpful. I said, you're not trying to help me. You're pissed because I didn't let you do X, Y, and Z like half an hour ago. And he'd go, you're right. You know, he would laugh and then he'd cough to it. And so we kept it honest, you know, between us, even with a kid, which I'm sure you do with your kids as well.
Oh, good.
You know, I mean, just to keep it, it's not that hard. I mean, the other thing is, you know, I know developmentally it's like a big deal, but also on some levels, it's not that hard.
Well, it's not, it doesn't look that hard. I mean, I see this all the time. I have an edge here, I'll tell you. You know, I'm observing myself.
Okay.
Because, you know, you take a conversation like ours, okay? You and I talking. But some of the listeners will go, well, that seems pretty simple. You know, Patricia and Keith like each other. They're just telling each other the truth. Well, you know what? There's an awful lot of self-regulation going on in Patricia and Keith. There's an awful lot of self, you know, you see a couple that are happy together dealing with an issue in a no-big-deal fashion. You go, God, that looks easy. Well, yeah, that's easy, but it's the total of years of development. And you are absolutely right about how we support each other's development. You know,
right.
The concept of Tantra has really been sexualized in the West, and sexual Tantra is about sex. But the Tantric practice is basically engagement with the world in a sense of I mirror the world and the world mirrors me. And if I'm with a person, I mirror that person and that person mirrors me. And if I'm awake to that, I keep on, that accelerates my development towards unity with God.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the tantric, that's the basics of tantric practice. And that's what this kind of mutuality does. It accelerates personal evolution and the evolution of relationships. And, you know, one of the hard things for people is they'll have a moment like that, and then, you know, they'll slip, they'll stun their toe, or, you know, they'll see their wife flirting with a guy at a party, and then they're all of a sudden regressed back 3 developmental levels, you know. And now that's fine if you acknowledge it.
Yeah.
But if not, you know, you're talking about being jealous, but you're trying to use all kinds of mutual, you know, spiritual terms. But really, what you're saying, God damn it, you know, you shouldn't have flirted with that guy. I'm threatened.
Totally.
So, like, that level.
Honest. I mean,
go on.
That it's genuine. I hate it when people get overly, like, spiritual and careful.
Yeah, right.
Be me. It's a relief, you know, when somebody just says it in a really vulnerable, direct way, you know, because it's more truthful. It's actually, it's more vulnerable, quite honestly.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's one of the hardest things is to actually say something where it just sounds goofy or it sounds petty. And the truth is that's really where you are in that moment.
I have a friend that I gave her my book, The Gift of Shame. And so I went and talked to her about it. And she said, Keith, it's way too dense. It's way too many end notes. You know, what the fuck? You know, I really liked the stories. Didn't like the dense, didn't like the end notes, and so on. I went, wow, that's great feedback. And I took that to heart in the next 2 books that I wrote. But that friend of mine, she's been kicked out of 5 or 6 different groups. You know why? Just start being honest like that with somebody, and they get all pissed off. They go, how dare you tell me that, you know, my painting isn't the greatest painting ever? Well, she didn't like that painting. You know, it's just And so that's part of the whole thing about social attunement. And also in integral, we say greater depth, less span. The more you can observe about this stuff, you know, there's people that can observe it with you, and that's great. You know, and then you adjust your level of discourse to that. And if someone can observe it with you, then that's where those lies that, you know, that you do to not hurt people come in. And you know, to me, those don't cause injuries. You know, I've seen this with couples. You know, when it's a real difference. You know, a couple goes, okay, we're going to have a non-exclusive relationship. Okay, so they go out and somebody falls in love with another person and it creates a great big mess, and they come back and they go, I guess I changed my mind about this non-exclusive relationship thing. Okay, now that couple had problems, but there's no sense of enduring injury. But you take a couple and a guy goes out and has a secret affair, and then she finds out about it because she saw his email, and his email was talking to, you know, so-and-so. That's a huge injury. Why?
Yeah.
Because it's a lie.
Right.
The same circuits in the brain, the same jealousy circuits, the same mate protection circuits are activated, the same sense of, you know, of distress, even a sense of betrayal. But because it was, one wasn't based in a lie, way easier to deal with, way easier to grow through. One based in a lie, really hard. 30% of couples don't grow through that. 70% do. 30% don't.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Also, too, like for, you know, people agree to, you know, at the beginning of a relationship to try, you know, to actually do their best to stay, you know, they're developing capacity for truth.
Mm-hmm.
Because I also think it's not only a consciousness, but it's also, you know, you deepen in your capacity to actually be that real with yourself and with other people. And it's a worthy skill. I mean, the other main piece is that when, in my experience, when you stay very close to what's there and what's real, and you both do, then instead of me manipulating the relationship or you manipulating the relationship by making, you know, making it look a certain way or saying things, you know, then the dynamism of life actually moves us, and we discover together the unfoldment of what actually is unfolding between us instead of somebody being. I think the power struggle for me is often that we're not just staying with what's actually happening and what's real.
Mm-hmm. And I think you're particularly good at that. I remember when you were starting the EC, you said, you know what I'm good at? I'm good at knowing bullshit from non-bullshit. I thought, wow, that's a great skill. And another thing, you know, you and I were talking about Almas, the Diamond Approach recently.
And
almost, if you look at almost all of the essential aspects, you know, he lists like, you know, 50 of them. All of them are based in a particular kind of combination of love and honesty.
Yeah.
You know, you cannot experience an essential aspect while you're lying to yourself or somebody else. You can't, none of them. All of them are neutralized by that. All of them have that essential quality of love and honesty. And then it leads into a sense of authenticity, a sense of personalness, you know, a sense of love, a sense of power, all those things. This, as an essential aspect, you know, needs to be love in it, there needs to be honesty in it. And I think Almas has the kind of mind that sees the bazillion different facets of that and then ties it together in the Diamond Approach, which is why so many people love him and love that approach. They can be drawn into that, all that love and that authenticity.
Well, people don't realize that the doorway or the portal to higher states of consciousness, you know, one of the tokens you have to pay is you can't be self-deceptive or being deceptive to others.
Yeah.
It just doesn't work. I mean, you have to pay that price.
It's what drove, I think, our generation away from the church. You know, we just couldn't stand, we couldn't feel that there were things, that just, there were deeper truths that weren't being spoken and deceptions that were being normalized. And so we had antibodies to that because we were given such good educations by our parents. We were taught critical thinking so well. And then, you know, like a lot of modernity, you know, we threw the spirituality baby out with the religious bathwater. We started coming back. And now I give lectures at the Unity Chapel in Santa Barbara. I love that congregation, you know, and I talked to the pastor. You know, he now if he embodied the kind of Christianity that he did when I was 13 or 14, I might never have left the church.
Mm-hmm.
I might never have gone in all the other directions that I went, because there's a certain level of authenticity and rigorous truth-seeking that has a liveliness about it. It's what Buddhists call lively awareness. You know,
mm-hmm.
Go all the way into, you take all the veils away. Daniel P. Brown translated this from the Mahamudra. It's what's called lively awareness. I love that term, lively awareness. I think honesty is a necessary quality of self and to other, of lively awareness.
Yeah, and it's not moral. It's more, I mean, to me, it's more of a living consciousness that one wants to live in.
Which is the higher levels of morality,
right?
Yeah.
Right, yeah. Because it, you know, it includes whatever's there. You know, you can't always control. Most of the time, you can't. You know exactly what's there, or how you feel, or you know what levels of truth. I mean, the other thing is the truth opens up the doorway to different dimensions of mm-hmm. reality. So that you can be more aware and more close to, you know, much more subtle realms instead of being stuck in a very gross level of life.
Yeah.
That's what
made me fall in love with Ken Wilber and integral stuff, and why I've written my books about integral psychotherapy. That there was a framework where you could have pure empiricism on one side, which is just a rigorous truth for the observable, search for the observable truth, and pure spirituality, where there's an undeniable experience of presence and of unity and of God in the first, second, and third person. And then there's a framework that connects all that stuff in a coherent framework. I was sold. I went, okay, this is what I've been looking for all my life, because now my science has God in it, and my God has science in it, and I have a mission that arises out of wherever through me. To be a force for love and good and healing in the world. Oh, boy.
So before we run out of time, I want to make sure people know how to find you.
Okay.
So it's www.drkeithwitt, with two T's, so drkeithwitt.com, right?
Mm-hmm.
And do you want to say anything about what they can hope to find on your website?
Yeah, I have School of Love 101, which gives you a short video, a few pages on a topic, and some things to do. I wanted, and you get each one of those classes once a week for 6 weeks. I wanted to have something that people could use that's easy to use, a little bit fun to listen to. The videos are kind of funny, and it gives you a chance to expand in different directions. The first one, School of Love 101, is free. The second one, 102, costs $10. I have a series of 17 lectures that I've given that you can buy for $10 or $15 if you want the video, on various topics that are all part of this kind of larger structure that I was talking about earlier. And you can...
And blogs, some videos, too. We're going to run out of time, unfortunately. So
yeah, okay, so I have a lot of stuff. You know, check out my website and look for what entertains you and resonates with you. That's all, yeah.
And Keith, just thank you. Thank you for our friendship, for our connection, and for you, you know, being who you are and doing what you do in the world. You know how much I love and respect you.
Oh, I love you, Patricia, so much.
Here's to creating a world where it's safer to be open and honest and...
A world
live in
full of kind honesty.
Yes, definitely. All right. Thank you, everybody. Thanks for listening. And I will talk to you. Actually, Jeff and Barbara Marks-Hubbard, I believe, will talk to you on our next call. Take care.
Thank you for participating in another Evolutionary Collective Conversation with Patricia Albert. For more information about the Evolutionary Collective and evolutionary relationships, please visit our website at www.evolutionarycollective.com, because the conversation is infinitely juicier with you in it.